still tidying up from the housing crisis. From APM, this is the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Jeff Horwich. It is January 7th. Two big mortgage-related settlements to fill you in on. Plus, who sports the worst bruises from the hockey lockout? Happy birthday, No Child Left Behind. And a big, fat, expensive fish. That's coming up.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
The mess left behind by the housing crisis is still being sorted out to this day to the tune of billions of dollars. This morning, we've got news of two unrelated settlements that both triggered distasteful flashbacks to 2007 and 2008. Let's go through them one by one with Marketplace's Eve Troe. Good morning, Eve.
Hey, good morning.
First, we have 14 banks settling up to the tune of $10 billion with federal regulators. And here the issue was foreclosure abuse. Tell us about what happened.
Well, basically, the government was mad back in 2011 about all the robo-signing allegations, if you remember those. And that was across all the major banks, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, Bank of America. And if you remember, it came out that they were issuing foreclosures in huge batches. They weren't examining each file like they were supposed to. The government said, you know, you guys got to go back and make sure that each of these foreclosures was actually justified. And that's turned out to be a huge expense, requiring thousands of independent consultants. So the banks finally said, okay, we'll just pay $10 billion, call it even. Now, the downside of that is that, you know, none of the homeowners who lost their homes are likely to get any amount of money that would help them get into another home again.
And separately, Eve, we have Bank of America today paying $3.6 billion to Fannie Mae. They have also agreed to buy back another $7 billion of mortgages from Fannie. What happened here?
Well, this is over mortgages issued by Countrywide, if you remember that name, which Bank of America bought 5 years ago. Now, Countrywide sold loans to Fannie Mae, and Fannie Mae says Countrywide never should have underwritten many of those mortgages to begin with. They were bad loans. This covers a period from 2000 to 2008. And what's going to happen is that Bank of America will wind up paying almost $7 billion for worthless, toxic assets. And like you said, the rest in cash to make up for the wrongdoing.
And what, if anything, can we make of these two settlements taken together?
Well, I talked to Chris Whalen at Tangent Capital Partners. He says we are getting a sense of how much it's going to cost the banks to clean up this foreclosure mess once and for all. And that's a positive. Also, he says rules on writing mortgages have become more strict to the point that he thinks a lot of banks are going to scale back on issuing them altogether. He also says it's just not as easy to foreclose on a homeowner these days.
There's a whole series of steps before you get to a foreclosure that we now have to go through with the homeowner to see if we can't help them. Modify the loan, maybe short sell them out of it if they don't want to stay in the house. But don't go just to a foreclosure the way we would have before the settlement.
So it may get us all riled up to remember some of the sins of the banks that led to the housing crisis. But he says things really are getting better.
Marketplace's Eve Troe on duty for us this morning. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Jeff.
For banks, as one analyst put it to us this morning, the hits just keep on coming. Meanwhile, the hits are set to resume on the rinks of the National Hockey League. The NHL and its players' union have a deal to end their nearly four-month lockout. A shortened season could begin as soon as next week. Andrew Zimbalist is a sports economist at Smith College. Good to talk with you.
Good morning.
I think many folks outside of diehard NHL fandom had almost forgotten this was even still going on. What would you say that we learned from this episode?
I think we learned that owners have a lot of power in professional sports leagues, and the NFL and the NBA owners flexed their muscles 2 years ago, and the NHL owners wanted to get some of the prizes. And so they locked out the players, and at the end of the day, they were able to reduce the player share, their salary share in total revenues, down from 57% to 50%.
Weren't the owners losing money the whole time this lockout continued? What gave them such power in the end?
Well, of course, when you're not playing games and you're not generating revenue, you're also not generating profits. But the good news for the owners is that they're knocking the player share down 7 percentage points, and that at current levels is worth about $230 million a year. So the owners should recoup those losses from not playing the first part of the season, assuming, of course, that fans don't become turned off and disaffected and show up in lower numbers.
Is this trend that you've mentioned, both in the NHL now and in other pro sports leagues, something that's bringing them into a more sustainable trajectory? Or is this really just the owners have more power and they're able to wring more out of the players?
Well, I think that the owners have more power. There have been some changes in labor law over the last 20 years that have given the owners a stronger hand. In the case of the NHL, it's been a poorly managed league. Its sustainability, I think, was in question. I think there need to be very serious management changes going forward to make the league strong.
They're talking about an abbreviated season now of maybe 50 games. Is that really enough for hockey to bounce back from this?
I think so. I'm quite confident that in Canada and in the strong North American cities, the fans will be responsive and go back to the arenas. In the half dozen to dozen U.S. franchises that were marginal to begin with, the fan response might not be nearly as positive.
Andrew Zimbalist is a sports economist. He's at Smith College. Thank you.
My pleasure.
It is the start of the first full week of trading since Congress hammered out a fiscal cliff compromise. And lawmakers this morning are staking out their positions for the next go-round. The White House says it will not negotiate over the debt ceiling. Republicans say any further tax hikes are off the table. Julia Coronado is here to look forward with us. She's chief economist at BNP Paribas, and she often joins us on Mondays to talk through the news. Good morning.
Good morning.
Last week, we had the best week for U.S. stocks in more than a year. Was that optimism warranted in your view, and will it persist?
I personally found it a little bit mystifying why the markets were so euphoric over the fiscal deal, particularly since the payroll tax pretty much locks in a weak start to the year. So I think we're starting to see reality setting in this morning. As you noted, the negotiations over the debt ceiling are getting underway, and that's no doubt going to be quite nasty.
We have the latest earnings season beginning tomorrow for the quarter just ended. What's your preview of that for us?
Well, I think that the earnings season is likely to be mixed as it was last time around. Some companies are doing well. Others are finding it hard to increase the top line. I think what we're going to be focused on is what is the guidance for the year ahead, particularly given the fiscal deal. How are companies thinking about 2013? Are they optimistic or pessimistic?
And just quickly, do you see much to change your impression from the jobs report that we got on Friday?
Well, I think the jobs report was really, truly more of the same. It was steady as she goes. It's not the worst scenario, but there's no signs of real improvement there. So, you know, I think we would like to see better job numbers than 150,000-ish. And at this rate, the unemployment rate's going to stay pretty high for a while.
Julia Coronado is chief economist at BNP Paribas. Thanks so much.
It's a pleasure.
And let's do the numbers. The reality of that next fiscal cliff fight might be setting in on Wall Street. So far this morning, stocks have pretty much erased their gains from Friday, at least. The Dow is down about 0.5%, sitting at 13,359. The S&P 500 is off about 0.6%. The NASDAQ is off 0.4%. As we said, the latest corporate earnings season gets underway tomorrow. It's traditionally kicked off with earnings from Alcoa. Not much in the way of economic data for you today, so how about this? From Tokyo, a record-setting fish story. Bloomberg News reports on the $1.8 million tuna. That is the largest price ever paid for a single fish. The tuna was 490 pounds, which comes out to about 10,000 pieces of sushi. The price was triple the previous record set last year. Seems there was something of a bidding war going on between two sushi powerhouses. The winner, Kiyomura, says it still intends to serve the sushi at a regular price.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
Happy almost birthday to No Child Left Behind. The Bush-era education law turns 11 tomorrow, which I guess means it's going into sixth grade. Its signature feature is that schools that don't meet its student achievement targets risk losing federal funding. Over more than a decade, No Child Left Behind has amassed critics from across the political spectrum, many of whom are keen for a rewrite. From our education desk at WYPR in Baltimore, here's Amy Scott.
No Child Left Behind wasn't meant to get this old. It was supposed to be rewritten in 2007.
You'd think Congress would be embarrassed at this point. that this is the longest it's ever taken to reauthorize an education law in U.S. history.
Charles Barone was the lead negotiator for House Democrats when No Child was written. It passed Congress with wide bipartisan support. Since then, the laws lost favor with both parties, but they haven't been able to agree on how to fix it. In the meantime, the Obama administration has granted waivers to many states on the law's strictest provisions. So Michael Petrilli with the Fordham Institute says there's less pressure for a rewrite.
And so for the foreseeable future, it looks like we are going to have this law in place, and any new policy at the federal level is probably at least 2 years off.
Pretty much everyone agrees No Child put a much-needed spotlight on raising academic achievement among poor and minority students. Critics don't like its emphasis on standardized tests, its narrow focus on math and reading, and what many call its unrealistic goals. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
A few months back, we were making a lot of trips to Loudoun County, Virginia, in the run-up to the election, and along the way, we introduced you to Sylvia Encinas. She was a single mom living in a homeless shelter in Loudoun County. Sylvia's life has tracked the tough economy. She lost her job, then her home. She and her daughter have been homeless for 3 years. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer returned to Loudoun County to see how Sylvia is doing.
The first time I interviewed Sylvia Encinas back in August, she teared up a lot. So I was braced for sadness when I picked her up for this latest interview.
Hi, how are you, Nancy?
I'm good.
But Sylvia looks good. Last time I saw her, her hair was stuffed carelessly into a ponytail, her shoulders slumped. Today, her hair is braided carefully. She's smiling. The homeless shelter doesn't allow reporters in, so we pick up Sylvia's daughter, Natalia, from school.
How was school today?
It's good.
And head to a quiet cafe, where I get a surprise. It's Sylvia's birthday.
Yeah. You're spending your birthday with me?
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Sylvia is starting her 28th year on an upbeat note, even when talking about the stress of homelessness, stress that's made a fair amount of that carefully braided hair fall out.
Yeah, definitely some stress, but there's a hair loss stuff, and it'll grow back.
And Sylvia may have solved her homelessness problem, too. She's been offered transitional housing, an apartment for 2 years. The catch? It's in a different town, so Natalia would have to switch schools. I ask her, what do you think?
I would love to stay in the house for 2 years and not keep moving back and forth, because that's just confusing.
It could help Sylvia find permanent work. She was just hired as a cashier at Target, but it's a temporary job. Ultimately, Sylvia wants to become a realtor. She and Natalia both have big dreams. When I ask Sylvia what she wants for her birthday, Natalia chimes in.
An education.
Well, to like buy college. My... master's degree.
Sylvia has to get her bachelor's degree first. Then she wants to buy a house again, to get back to where she was before the financial crisis hit. I drive Sylvia and Natalia back to the shelter, hoping the next time I see them, they'll have taken a few more halting steps toward a better life.
See you.
Thanks,
in
guys.
3 months?
Maybe. Bye, guys.
In Loudoun County, Virginia, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
And finally, I have told you before here on the podcast about noteworthy innovations in higher education degrees, like the new major in social media that was recently rolled out at a college in South Carolina. Today, it's the University of Arizona that's getting a little bit of scrutiny for the country's first minor in hip-hop. The concentration is housed within the Africana Studies Department. The school quotes a professor in the discipline who says hip-hop has become a part of the, quote, fabric of humanity, as legitimate a course of study as Baroque art or quilting. Interesting choice of types of art to compare it to, but there you have it. I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is all for today's Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.